broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon each weekday. And the phone lines are open for an hour each weekday afternoon for you to call if you have questions about the Bible or about the narrow path that we walk. The narrow path, of course, is the path of discipleship following Jesus. We might say Jesus himself is the narrow path because he said, I am the way. And, of course, a way means a pathway. So he is the way. He said no one comes to the Father but through him. And yet he said the path that leads to eternal life is narrow and difficult. So it's not the easiest thing in the world to be on the path, but it is certainly worthwhile because Jesus said that the road that leads to destruction is broad and easy and many go their way. So we talk about this matter of what it means to be a Christian, what it means to follow Jesus, what the Bible teaches on various subjects day by day. We've been doing this daily program in these afternoons for how long? Since I forget what month we began, but it was 1997. That puts us well in about 14 years we've been doing this program in the afternoons. We also have a morning half-hour program that airs on some different stations and is going to be airing in Denver beginning at the end of this week. So we're going to be having a Denver, Colorado Springs, Boulder audience for our morning program on KLTT AM in Denver. So if you have friends in that area, you might tell them to tune in beginning this Friday. The morning program is in their time zone, 10:30 to 11. So you might want to let your friends in Colorado know that they can hear a live half-hour version of the program in the mornings from 10:30 to 11 in their time zone. That's from 9:30 to 11 here on the Pacific. And you can catch that from our website, since you probably can't catch it on the radio from where you're listening. The purpose of the program is to take calls and hear your questions, maybe hear your corrections if you think that there's been a mistake made by the host and the information given is not correct. Feel free to call and say so. And as you know, if you listen to the program, I will give you the opportunity to make your case. That doesn't mean I won't argue it with you if I think you're mistaken. But we can have a cordial conversation, and hopefully a learning situation will result. If you'd like to be on the program, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090, and we'll be taking calls in just a moment. I just want you to know also that our website is quite a resource. We have lots of MP3 files, a lot of lectures there that you can download, hundreds of them, many hundreds, and they're all for free. And you won't find anything for sale there at the website. And you can just take them and use them, and many people do. If you've never been there, you should check that out. That is thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. We're going to talk first of all to Gabriel, calling from Santa Cruz, California today. Gabriel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. I'm actually hitting Gabriel's button. Okay, I've got you now, Gabriel. Welcome.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Thanks for sharing your incredible knowledge. God gets the knowledge bestowed upon you. Really, we really appreciate it. My question, I'm going back to, I had this talk with you a long, long time ago about Genesis chapter 6.
Yeah.
About the angels. I heard something very extremely fascinating on some talk show, Defending the Truth, where it was very fascinating. I really believe that in Genesis chapter 6, and I'll give you a couple new reasons why, that was really angels. When I first read it, I believed it was angels.
Uh-huh.
And one thing about it, it says the sons of God. Now, something occurred to me that if it was like, say if it was like sons of God, like, you know, like how we say if you're a son of God, you know, you're Jesus, if we have in Jesus, we're sons of God. Well, wouldn't that mean also, wouldn't they also say the children of God, meaning daughters also? Don't you think of it wasn't just that, you know, people, the sons of God having sex with the women, but the women possibly having sex with the men. And another key thing is that the angels, there's no such thing as a female angel. Angels are only males. So that's another reason why I kind of really believe that that was angels that were mating with daughters of men.
Well, you know, a lot of our listeners may not know the story that well, but it's in Genesis 6. It says the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful to look upon, and they took wives of them as many as they chose. And so the question is, the sons of God, are these angels or are these men? Now, Gabriel, you're suggesting that since angels are always represented as male, that that points to these sons of God being angels. But, of course, men are also male, and if it's talking about men, it would also say sons of God. If it's my impression that it's more likely to be a reference to godly men, that is, men from godly families who have kept alive the knowledge of God in a fallen world after the fall, and who are now beginning to compromise by marrying women who are not godly, women from the other families who were not following God. And that would, of course, warrant the use of the masculine term sons, too, because they would be males. Now, I don't know if it would be as significant if the daughters of God, that is, if godly women, were marrying pagan men, because the women generally did not carry on the family name or the family heritage or the inheritance or anything like that. So who a daughter married was much less determinative of anything in the future than who a man married. If a man married the proper persons, then his offspring would carry on the family line. Now, if they were not godly offspring because they didn't have godly mothers, that could have repercussions in the family and in the tribe and in the world. If a woman who's godly married an ungodly man, which would be not a good thing, but it wouldn't, the children would not be, you know, as affected because they're not coming from a godly family. The man is the one who determines the identity of the family. So, in a sense, that's introducing a godly element into a family that's already ungodly. I don't know. I mean, this, I don't really see that your comments would necessarily make the case, but there are a lot of people like yourself who do believe it is a reference to angels. I'm not convinced that it is. There's, to my mind, certain objections that present themselves to angels actually being able to have reproductive relationships with women. But I appreciate your points. Thanks for calling.
What about the point about, you know, angels were able to eat food?
Yeah, what about that?
Well, if they're able to eat food and you know, take the form of a man, they're able to consume food. How could they? Isn't that, you know, somewhat of a sign that they're maybe able to mate?
Well, maybe. I mean, to ingest food simply requires that food go through a portal in the front of the face and disappear from view. We don't know if those angels ever, you know, digested food and eliminated food and so forth like people do. I mean, it was in the case of the angels that appeared in human form, it appears to have been just a temporary appearance. It wasn't like they came down and started families. They were angels that appeared in a human form to commune with Abraham and such, and they were able to bring in food. You see, reproduction requires something more than that, and that is, it requires genetic compatibility. And so the angels would have to have human genetics in order to reproduce with humans, and that's what I find somewhat difficult to imagine. Now, the angels that ate with people were godly angels, and we have reason to believe that God is the one who allowed them to materialize. God is the one who, you know, gave them whatever powers they had to appear and to relate with men and eat with men and so forth. But if these angels came down and mated with women, that they would not be having God on their side. God would not be favorable to this. I don't think that he would give them the power to materialize for that purpose. So I'm not convinced that there's any real case for that.
Do you know when the next time where it mentions the Son of God after Genesis 6, do you know when that is? And is that referring to angels or is it referring to people?
Well, I think the next time it's mentioned would be in Job chapter 1, and many people believe the sons of God are angels there. But okay. Some think not. Some think they're people.
Okay, so then it's kind of back and forth again. Okay.
Yeah, it's uncertain.
I was very fascinated yesterday from one, the person who has that show, Defending the Truth. He could not say, normally people get cornered on that show. They go on there. There was no cornering this gentleman. He was very crafty. He used all kinds of verses. It was very intriguing. And one thing he said that was fascinating is he believes that angels built the pyramids. Do you have any theory about how the pyramids were built other than that?
No theories. No theories whatsoever.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. God bless you, Steve.
Okay, you too, Gabriel. Thanks for the call. Excuse me. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can reach me at this line that has just opened, 1-800-438-5090. Our next call comes from Ben, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Ben, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Quick question for you. Discussion came out with some brothers of mine, brothers in Christ, about divorce and remarriage. If a Christian is biblically sound to divorce due to the spouse being unfaithful and committing adultery, can the Christian get remarried?
Oh, okay, now what I need to say is going to be unpopular with some people, because if I say yes, they can, then there's going to be some people listening who are angry at me. If I say no, they can't, there's going to be some people listening angry at me. So whenever this question comes up, I'm going to have people angry at me. I know because I hear from them. Anyway, my opinion is that when a person is legitimately divorced, that is when the grounds are, in fact, as Jesus said, fornication, that frees them from the marriage. And if they're freed from the marriage, they are single. And if they're single, I don't believe they have to remarry. I mean, I don't think they have to remain single. I think they can remarry. That's what I mean.
Because they don't have, obviously they don't have the gift of singleness.
Well, it would not seem so. You know, a person who has gotten married usually has done so because they don't have the gift of singleness. And then if they have been abandoned by their spouse through no fault of their own, then it seems to me that, you know, we would not assume that they are people with the gift of singleness. Unless, of course, we might say that God would give it to them, because if one were to say that it is immoral for them to remarry, and I don't say that, but some people do. If someone were to say, well, it's immoral for them to remarry in such cases, they might say, well, then the very fact of being divorced would mean that God would give you the gift of singleness.
Is there any biblical support for either side of that argument?
Well, yes, probably for both sides. That's the problem.
Okay.
There's arguments for both sides, certainly. There's actually not just two, but three or four views of divorce and remarriage that Christians have held. And they have arguments for all of them. The problem, the reason it's confusing, is because there's only a very few verses in the Bible that actually talk directly on the subject of divorce. There's, of course, a reference to it in Deuteronomy 24. There's a law about divorce and remarriage there. It permits divorce and remarriage there. But Jesus had twice that he spoke about divorce. One was in Matthew 5:32, and one was in Matthew 19:9. And in both cases, he said about the same thing. He said, whoever divorces his wife for any cause other than fornication commits adultery, and he causes his wife to commit adultery, and whoever marries her commits adultery. So these two statements are fairly close in wording, that a person who divorces their spouse without grounds of fornication cannot remarry, and the wife cannot remarry without it being adulterous. And yet, he is speaking into, of course, a certain Jewish milieu that had certain presuppositions that he might not have been meaning to cancel out. There's not much there except those statements. But when he said, except for the cause of fornication, some people think that means that you can divorce your spouse for fornication, but you can't remarry. Others believe that you can divorce your wife because of fornication, but you cannot remarry. Other people believe that you can't divorce your wife for any reason or remarry, and that the reference, except for the cause of fornication, is referring to, well, some people think it's been added to the text. There's no textual reason to believe that, but that's just their view. So there's a lot of different views on this. But I believe we have to draw our ethics about this not simply from two or three verses in the Bible that say something about divorce directly, but actually about the teaching in general about what marriage is. You know, when Jesus was asked if it's lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause, he didn't begin by answering directly about divorce, but he began by reminding his listeners what marriage is. Because divorce simply is the dissolution of a marriage. And therefore, to talk about what divorce is and what it involves, you have to understand what it is that it's dissolving, what a marriage is. So Jesus went back to the Garden of Eden and said, God made the two one flesh. And he said, if God made them one, then you shouldn't divide what God has put together. But he does say that he goes on to say, if a man divorces his wife for any other reason than fornication, then he's going to be sinning. And his wife will end up probably in a morally compromised marriage too. So anyway, looking at the larger teaching about marriage, and especially what marriage is supposed to be and what God teaches us about it from his own marriage relationship with Israel, is very important. You know, we don't just go by a couple of verses that are summary statements, but looking at the whole character of God, the whole counsel of God about marriage and divorce, and how God himself said that he had divorced Israel. He said he had divorced her and given her a writing of divorcement in Jeremiah.
Right.
So and then he said in Deuteronomy, I think it's in chapter 30, if I'm not mistaken, of Deuteronomy, might be chapter 31. He told Israel, you know, if you cheat on me, I'll go find someone else. You know, he said, if you worship other gods, I'll go get another people. So it's like saying, we're married to each other. If you worship other gods, I will consider you to be committing adultery. And if you do that, I'll go find another wife. Basically, that's what he's saying. I'll go to a different people. So certainly the idea is woven throughout the Old Testament as well as the New that marriage is a covenant relationship, but covenants require faithfulness on both sides. And if one person totally defaults on the covenant, shatters it, then the innocent party is not bound to the covenant. And that's what happens when a spouse goes out and commits adultery, they're breaking the covenant.
Right.
And the innocent party in the marriage then has options. They can forgive and try to keep the marriage going, or they can say, well, you broke the covenant, I'm out of it too. And either one seems to be a legitimate option. That doesn't mean that a person should necessarily get divorced when there's adultery. But your question was, once they're divorced on those grounds, can they remarry? And that's another whole issue of controversy. But I believe that the example of God with Israel and his marriage, and also the implications of his statement, of Jesus' statement about except for the cause of fornication, and also 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 12 through 15, talk about the believer of an unbelieving spouse. The partner of an unbelieving spouse who departs from them, the believer is not under bondage in such cases. I think that means they're not bound to the marriage. If they're not under bondage, that means they're free. Free what? Free to be remarried, I think.
Amen. Hello?
All right.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve, and keep up the great work. God bless you, brother.
Okay, Ben. God bless you.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We have lines open for you at 1-800-438-5090. We're going to talk to Renee from Aurora, Oregon. And we could get you on before the hour is done if you call now, 1-800-438-5090. Renee, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have a question about Matthew 24, on the end of the age, and I hope I'm not setting up for more angry callers, but my question, I'd like it off the air, too, so I can take notes, but my question is, I've always gotten confused. The only two teachings I've ever gotten in is that it was all completed at the end of the age in 70 A.D. or the dispensational, and both don't seem to jive with me on this passage.
Yeah.
The dispensational part, this generation will no means pass away till all these things take place, which sounds like 70 A.D.,
yeah.
But then later it says, and he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds from the end of heaven to the other, which sounds like it's in the future. So I guess I just like your thoughts and teaching on that.
Okay. You wanted to take it off the air so you could take notes?
Please, yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling, Renee.
All right, bye.
Bye now. I might say before I go into this that there's extensive, detailed teaching on this chapter by yours truly at our website, MP3 files. You can listen to my lectures on this. And I think I leave no stone unturned, but I will have to leave some stones unturned here today for the simple reason that we have a different format here and not unlimited time. But if you want, after I've finished speaking, in answer to your question, if you want a more detailed answer, you can go to thenarrowpath.com. And if you click on the topical lectures link, you'll find that there's a series, if you scroll down, called When Shall These Things Be? And When Shall These Things Be? Is a 14-lecture series on the end times, but there's several lectures in it on the Olivet Discourse, which is Matthew 24, and the parallels. Okay, so I'm just letting you know if you don't get a complete answer here on the air, because it is a rather involved question, you can get a complete answer by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Now, is Matthew 24 about A.D. 70, or is it about the end of the world when Jesus returns? And you said you've only heard really two positions. One apparently is the preterist view, which applies all of it to A.D. 70, and the other is the dispensational or the futurist view, which applies all of it to the future. I believe the answer lies somewhere in between there, and that's not just because I want to waffle between two things, but I think there's evidence that that two different things are involved here, and that part of the chapter is talking about A.D. 70, and the other part is talking about the end of the world and the second coming of Christ. Now, I would divide it at verse 34, between verse 34 and verse 35, or maybe between verse 35 and 36, because in verse 34 of Matthew 24, Jesus says, "As surely I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all these things take place." Now, what are these things that are going to take place before that generation passes away? Presumably the things he said earlier in the chapter. The chapter essentially commenced with the disciples hearing Jesus predict the destruction of the temple. He said not one stone would be left standing on another. Of course, that happened in A.D. 70. And the disciples came to him and said, "When will these things be?" Now, by "when will these things," he means, of course, the destruction of the temple, because that's what Jesus predicted. And, of course, in verse 34 it says, "This generation will not pass before these things happen." So they asked a specific question about these things, the destruction of the temple, and when will it be? His specific answer was, these things will happen before this generation is over. So he gave a direct answer to their question. The temple was destroyed within their generation, within 40 years. Okay? Now, when he has said that about the previous material, he then says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away." And then the next line, verse 36, says, "But of that day and hour, no one knows." Now, he has given them a time for the destruction of Jerusalem. He said it'll be, in this generation. But then he's talking about something else, a different event that no one knows when that'll be. He's not going to even, venture an estimate. He says, no one knows. He says, the angels of God don't know. He said, even the Son, meaning himself, even I don't know, he says. He said, only my Father knows that. So they asked him a question of timing about something. And what they asked him about was the destruction of Jerusalem. And he could answer that question. But he can't answer when the heavens and earth will pass away. See, in verse 35, he said, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows." What day and hour? I think the day and hour that he referred to in the previous verse, which is when the heavens and the earth pass away. At that point, I think he's no longer talking about 70 A.D., but he's talking about the end of the cosmos, the end of the world, when he comes back. And I believe that the verses that follow verse 36 on through chapter 24 and through 25 are most readily and most easily interpreted as being about the second coming of Christ at the end of the world, still future. So I would have the first 34 verses of Matthew 24 applicable to AD 70 and all the verses that follow it applicable to the end of the world. So two subjects come up, and he introduces the second subject by saying heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not. But having mentioned the destruction of the heavens and the earth, he says that day, no one knows when that's going to be. Now, there's still a problem remaining, and that is that if all these things that will happen within this generation in verse 34 includes all the things mentioned before verse 34, as I'm suggesting, then we've got a slight problem with some of those verses that precede verse 34, especially verse, let's say, 29 and following. In verse 29, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Now, that doesn't sound like something that happened within that generation, does it? Well, it doesn't sound like it to our ears, but it does to the Jewish ear, because this expression, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall, or the stars will be darkened, these expressions are used many, many, many times in the Old Testament. And when they are used, they are referring to the judgment of some nation, not at the end of the world, but in history. It is, for example, in Isaiah 13:10. It says this very thing about the fall of Babylon. Now, Babylon fell in 539 B.C. But it says that when Babylon falls, it says the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light and the stars will be darkened too. And in Isaiah 34, it talks about the destruction of the nation of Edom. Now, that nation came to its end in the 2nd century B.C. Okay, that kingdom's been gone for over 2,000 years now. And it says that the heavens will be shaken, the hosts, meaning the stars, will fall to the ground like figs from a tree, from a fig tree that's shaken by the wind. The heavens will be rolled up like a scroll. This is all connected to the fall of Edom, an ancient nation that's long gone now. In Ezekiel 32, it's talking about the Babylonian conquest of Egypt. And it says about Egypt that the sun and the moon will be made dark over Egypt and the stars will not give their light. There's many references to this in the Old Testament. Jesus is using very typical prophetic language. The sun and the moon being dark and the stars falling. These are all images of some great calamity, political calamity, on some significant nation. Whether it's Babylon, whether it's Egypt, whether it's Edom, these terms are used. And so Jesus, if he is in fact talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, he's very justified in using the same kind of language that the prophets always used of this kind of thing. Or I shouldn't say always, but frequently used of it. It certainly was not unprecedented. He's using language that would be familiar. So he says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and it says, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. That's all agreeable with the language of temporal judgments as the prophets spoke of them in apocalyptic passages. Verse 30 says, in Matthew 24:30, it says, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Now, that certainly sounds like it's talking about the second coming of Christ, but is it? It says they will see the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens. It's not clear what the sign of the Son of Man is that someone would see in heaven, though there were signs seen in the heavens at the time that Jerusalem was about to fall to the Romans. We know this because there was a historian who wrote about it. His name is Josephus, and he was there. He was involved in that very war, in that very year, in that very place. And he said there were many signs that appeared. Not one of them that he thought was significant was, he said, a star the shape of a sword appeared over Jerusalem and hung in the sky there for about a year. Could that be the sword of judgment? I don't know. Josephus talks about it. The Bible doesn't. He also said there was a time when the inhabitants looked up into the clouds and saw what he said looked like soldiers in armor running in the clouds. And so those things could certainly be called signs in heaven. They could be the sign of the Son of Man. They could be the sign that Jesus is vindicating himself upon that city that crucified him and killed the prophets before him. It's possible. We don't know what the sign of the Son of Man is that would be seen in heaven, but that those signs that were seen in 70 AD could easily be what he's referring to. Those who were there might easily associate them with that. I don't know. And it says that they will see the Son of Man, or it says the tribes of the earth will mourn. Now, this sounds like it's a global thing there, if all the tribes of the earth mourn, but really, the word earth in the Greek is ge, and it can be translated earth, but very often it is translated land. And if he said all the tribes of the land shall mourn, which is equally good translation, the tribes of the land would mean the tribes of the land of Israel. Israel was divisible into tribes, 12 tribes. Usually we don't speak in the Bible of the tribes of the earth. It's more like the nations of the earth. The tribes are the tribes of Israel. And so the translation needs to be reconsidered here. Our Bible says the tribes of the earth will mourn, but it could as easily be translated the tribes of the land shall mourn. In which case, it's talking about the destruction of Israel, not of the world. And it's the mourning of the 12 tribes, not a mourning of the whole world. And then it says they'll see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Well, this too is language of judgment from the Old Testament that's not necessarily always applied to our idea of the second coming of Christ. Now, I do believe in the second coming of Christ. Sometimes people get me wrong because they take what I say and they stretch it out beyond what I'm saying. But what I am saying is this. The prophets in the Old Testament sometimes use figurative language about judgments. When God was bringing a judgment on a nation, which usually took the form of a military invasion by another nation, it is often said in the prophets that this was God coming to them, God visiting them, and so forth. This is a reasonably common expression in the Old Testament prophets. In fact, in Isaiah 19:1, there's an expression almost identical to this. And in Isaiah 19:1 is talking about when the Assyrians were being brought by God to conquer Egypt, which was, of course, way back many hundreds of years before Christ. And in the prophecy about that event, it begins, "The Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt." You know, now that's interesting because it was not the second coming of Christ. It talks about God on a cloud coming to Egypt. Well, Jesus says they'll see the Son of Man coming on a cloud. That's exactly the same imagery. But in the, you know, the precedent for this, in Isaiah 19:1, it's not talking about a personal appearance of God or of Christ. It's talking about the armies of Assyria, who are the agents of God, coming to Egypt and bringing judgment. But figurative language is used to say God himself is coming to Egypt on a cloud. Well, that's how Jesus says they will see the Son of Man coming on a cloud. That could mean, if the apostles are applying, if his listeners are applying the canons of interpretation that they already applied to the prophets, they would understand that that simply means a judgment from God, a judgment from Christ, again, vindicating those who persecuted him and crucified him. It could take the form of an army coming, because that's what it did when the same language was used in the Old Testament. So all these phrases that we apply to the second coming of Christ, we often do so because we are not familiar, as we really should be, with the language the Old Testament prophets used when speaking about earthly judgments. And Jesus may well be speaking about an earthly judgment. He may be talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and using exactly the same phrases that the prophets in the Old Testament used when they talked about the destruction of Babylon or Egypt or Edom or other nations. Now, there's one other thing in this section that you mentioned, and that is, he says in verse 31, "Then he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." Now, the gathering in of the elect is here mentioned to be done by angels that are sent out to do it. If this is talking about angels in the sky, angels in heaven coming, then it would have to almost certainly be the second coming of Christ we're looking at here. And perhaps that's what it is. But we need to not jump to conclusions too quickly, because the word angels, the Greek word angeloi, is simply the ordinary word for messengers. We use the English word angel to speak specifically of messengers that are supernatural agents, who, spirits that come down from God and minister and so forth and bring messages from God. And we see them active in the Bible many times. But the same word angeloi, angels, which in Greek just means messengers, is sometimes used of human messengers too. In fact, even in the Bible it is. In the Gospel of Mark, I think it's Mark, it says that John the Baptist, when he was in prison, he sent messengers to Jesus asking him, are you the one who's to come? The word that is used in the Gospel in the Greek is the word angeloi. John the Baptist sent angels to Jesus. But that's not because he sent heavenly angels. It's that the word angels in the Greek means messengers, and it can mean human messengers or heavenly messengers. It just depends on context. But if this is talking about 70 AD, and if we read the statement to say, then he will send his messengers, because that's what angeloi means, his angels, then he will send his messengers out to the whole world to gather in his elect, that would be very agreeable with what the Bible teaches generally, is that as a result of God's rejection of the old order and his destruction on Jerusalem, the gospel went out through God's messengers to all the world to gather in, that is, into the church, into Christ, to gather in all the elect. It would not be a reference to anyone going up in the sky or going to heaven in this case. It would be a reference simply to the evangelistic mission of the church. Okay, so, I mean, there's about five lines in this one little section of Matthew 24, which we very naturally, partly because of our ignorance of, you know, apocalyptic language that's frequently used elsewhere in Scripture, we take it quite literally and make it be the end of the world and the second coming of Christ, but that's not necessarily how his readers would have taken it or how he would have intended for them to. The fact that he says all these things will happen, and then three verses later says, and this generation will not pass before all these things happen, strongly suggests that he is in these verses as well as the others of that section. And he's talking about AD 70. But I do believe that the second coming of Christ at the end of the world does come into consideration, but not until verse 36. That's my take on it, and I hope that that helps. As I said, if it's not adequate, if you want a more thorough treatment of all the scriptures relevant to it, there are lectures at my website you can download for free, MP3 files. And once again, for those who tuned in late and may be interested in those lectures, you go to thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Then you click on the link that says topical lectures. Then you find the series that's called When Shall These Things Be? Once you've found that, you can look at the titles of the lectures. You'll see there's some on the Olivet Discourse. That's where we discuss Matthew 24 in great detail. Let's talk to Vicki next from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Vicki. Welcome.
Hi. I wasn't sure you were going to get to me.
I know. I took a long time on that last question.
Yeah. I'm glad you explained that, though. I studied that a long time ago, and I can never, ever get it out long enough to convince anyone.
Yeah, well, it takes a while. That's why I couldn't give a short answer.
Yeah, right. I'm calling in regards to the gentleman who called about the Genesis 6:6.
Yeah.
About the sons of God and daughters of men. When I first started studying the Bible, I was always told that the Bible's pretty straightforward, except for the poetry, perhaps, and the portions that are to be read as being symbolic, and it lets you know ahead of time which is which.
Yeah.
But Genesis, for the most part, is a history book. So when I read this 6:6 the first few times, I agreed with the interpretation of the other person, and in fact, I still do, because it made sense to me from what he was saying. God created all these people. They were nice and everything. He did everything for them. And then we have a break. It said, when mankind began to multiply on the earth, the daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw that the daughters of man were beautiful. Now, to me, that's the first time in the Bible that this introduction of the daughters of men and the sons of God has been mentioned. So I immediately assumed the angels, and then I assumed the angels had been kicked out of heaven and I've always kind of assumed they were living on Earth somewhere. And so this would be their domain, and maybe they could do what they wanted to. I don't know. But, and then it went on to talk about Nephilim or Nephilim, and that really doesn't have anything to do with my thinking on it. But
yeah,
it, to me, it just makes sense. And then I was it was explained to me with great detail why it was those really were talking about Cain and Abel and the different families and that were on the way down. And so I accepted it, and I couldn't come back with anything. And then as I read on, I read in Jude, in verse 5:5, it says, and this is Jude speaking.
Yes.
Now I want to remind you, I think it's Jude.
It is, yes.
Okay. I want to remind you, though you know all these things, the Lord, having first of all saved the people out of Egypt, later destroyed those who did not believe, and he was kept with eternal. And that's the end of that one. And he was kept with eternal chains in darkness. Has kept with eternal chains in darkness for the judgment of the day. The great day, angels who did not keep their own position, but deserted their proper dwelling. And then he goes on to say, in the same way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them committed sexual immorality. Now, that sexual immorality was always made out as being a big, a horrendous, or what is, an abomination before the Lord. And so here we get reference to these angels somehow were different than the rest. And they were now chained in darkness, waiting for the judgment on that great day, because they did not keep their position, but deserted their proper dwelling.
Yep.
So that, with that in mind, too, then I went back to thinking of the other, and it kind of, thought, well, maybe I'm not so wrong.
Well, maybe you're not. I mean, there's a lot of people who think you're right. Oh, definitely, including the Jewish rabbis and the Book of Enoch, and a very large number of Christians believe that that's right, that the sons of God are angels. I've mentioned before that I have problems with that theory, and I think it doesn't have as much in its favor as an alternative theory, but the connection with Jude is considered to be a strong one here to support that notion, because he mentions the angels that did not keep to their first estate, and they're kept in chains under darkness, awaiting the judgment of the great day. That says, even as Sodom and Gomorrah,
right, and
went after, you know, committed immorality, and went after strange flesh. So many people feel that what Jude is saying is that the sin of these angels was comparable to, or was parallel to, the sins in Sodom and Gomorrah of people going after the wrong stuff for sexual. For the wrong partners for sex. Now, and that could be what Jude is saying. If he is, then that presents a pretty strong support for that particular interpretation of Genesis 6, because it would suggest that what he means when he said the angels didn't keep their first estate is that he's talking about the sons of God going after women, and that would have to be Genesis 6, since there's no other references to anything like that in the Old Testament. And maybe he is saying that. If he is, then I'm probably wrong. Now, the other possibility is that Jude is saying, he's giving a list of cases where God has judged sinners, setting a precedent that he will judge sinners at all times. And he gives the example of the angels, and that they have been consigned to judgment because of their sin of not keeping their first estate. And he then moves to another example, the people in like manner God has judged Sodom and Gomorrah for their particular sins. He might not be making reference to a similarity in the kinds of sins
right.
that the angels committed, but he might be the similarity may be in the fact of God judging them. So it's hard to know whether he is comparing the sins of the angels with the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, or whether he's simply saying angels are one example of sinners that God has judged. Sodom and Gomorrah are another instance of sinners that God similarly judged.
It struck me that he was talking about morality, sexual morality, that was particularly egregious to him.
Yeah.
This was about the worst that could happen.
Well, like I say, you're in very good company in that viewpoint.
And then, but the other, on the other hand, too, when they say the sons of God might be the children following Cain, that makes sense, too, because of the way it's used. But it, to me, it isn't a stronger case just because it's used one other place.
Well, I think, yeah, it's not suggested that the sons of God were the descendants of Cain, but rather the descendants of Seth is usually brought up.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't even go that far.
Oh, good.
I would just say the sons of God is a reference that could refer to godly men. Whether they're descended from Seth or from anyone else, you don't have to be of a certain family in order to be godly. But the idea is that the people of God have often been referred to as God's sons. So it would be possible that in those days, this is just before the flood of Noah, that there were some godly people, and they would have perhaps preserved a godly seed and maintained a godly influence in society, except that they compromised in their choice of marriage partners. Thus, their children were raised by mixed marriage parents, and you know, compromising, therefore, the parental influence for godliness in the family, and therefore children grew up without that influence, and society got worse. But anyway, those are definitely two different theories that people have, and I appreciate you sharing that. We need to talk to another caller before we're out of time, though, and so we're going to talk to Matt from Seattle. Matt, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. So I'm going to try and make this sound as less as heresy as I possibly can.
It's always good to try to minimize our heresies, yes.
Well, I just I don't want to be that crazy guy like at my church that believes the Lord can't tell the future and he plays us like a game of chess. He just comes out to end up, you know, prophecies. And that's how they get fulfilled.
Is that what your church thinks, that that's crazy?
Well, no. That was just some guy on a men's retreat. I was talking with him, and he seriously believes in. My other pastor, who I know, says, "Oh yeah, there's a lot of Christians who believe that the Lord can't tell the future, and He just aligns the pieces, and that's how prophecies get fulfilled." And I'm just like, "Really? Oh, thank you, Jesus. I'm not like that guy, but I actually kind of think mine is a little worse." I'll just be honest. I've been studying the doctrine of Calvinism, and with an open eye, with an open heart, and be honest with you, I think the Bible teaches both, because we have one scripture that says, and help me on it, it says something like, no one can come to the Father unless it's granted by the Son.
Yeah, that's stated twice in John 6, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's the one, whoever shall believe upon the Lord shall be saved. And I was almost kind of thinking the Bible was contradicting itself, or that the writers were mistaken, but then they were inspired by God. So wouldn't that be, you know, God making the mistake of telling the people? I was wanting to ask you what you think about that, because I honestly think that the Bible teaches both, not just one view.
Well, let me ask you this, Matt. Are you married?
No.
Okay. Suppose you were thinking about getting married. And there were a lot, let's say a lot of women found you to be a good catch and a very attractive option. And there were lots of women making their interest known to you. And so you gave a general announcement, said, no one can be my wife unless I choose them. You know, unless I propose to you, give it up, you know, because I'm not just going to let you propose to me. In other words, I have to propose to you. And unless I propose to you, I'm not going to marry you. Okay. So then you go out and you propose to somebody. Now, does that person have free choice or not? If you propose to a girl, does she have the choice to say yes or no?
Yeah, she does have the choice.
Right. So it can be true that no one can be your wife unless you propose to them first. But it's also true that they have free will. Even if you do propose to them, they can say no. So...
Yeah.
So Jesus could say, no one can come to me unless the Father draws him. But he can still say, but you still have to say yes. If you don't say yes, it won't happen. You still have free choice. Now, to say that Calvinism and Arminianism are both true, I'm afraid that just won't work, because what we call Calvinism are five affirmations. I realize that's oversimplifying it, but it's the Calvinists themselves who reduced it to this to be helpful. You know, the 5 points of Calvinism. Now, what the 5 points of Calvinism are, they formulated them to respond to the 5 points of Arminius. Now, the 5 points of Arminianism were formulated by the followers of Jacob Arminius they were called the Remonstrants. They were Arminians. They had 5 affirmations that they said characterized the beliefs of Arminius. When the Calvinists met to formulate the 5 points of Calvinism, they simply took the 5 points of Arminius and contradicted them. Okay? So, you know, Calvinism says there's unconditional election, but Arminius said, no, it's conditional upon faith. You know, Calvinists say, if you're truly the elect, you will necessarily persevere. Arminius says, no, it's possible to fall away. In other words, you can't affirm the 5 points of Calvinism and the 5 points of Arminianism, because they are flatly contradictory to each other, and deliberately so. They were formulated in order to contradict each other. So the Bible can't teach two things that are contradictory to each other, because truth cannot contradict truth. So what we would have to say is the verses that the Calvinists use are definitely true, and the verses that the Arminians use are definitely true, but somehow they're not being put together properly by one side or the other.
And that's what I was saying. They can't both be true, and you know, and I don't know if I told you my theory. Built up kind of a theory that the Lord, is in control, and that He does the predestined some to do His work, but anybody else who wants to come, you know, can come along. You know, but if you choose to live your life of sin, then you're going to pay for it. But and I don't want to seem like the Lord didn't want somebody, but it's just kind of like, you know, if you need a house built, you don't hire, you know, a musician to build your house. The Lord would choose a contractor to build his house in that sense. I don't know how bad that sounds, but, you know,
Well, I'm not sure how bad it sounds, because I'm not sure I understand the ins and outs of it. If you're saying that most people do have free will, but there's some individuals that God calls specially and sovereignly because He has a special plan for them to build His church, someone like Jeremiah, who was called from his mother's womb, or Paul, who was separated from his mother's womb, that is a respectable viewpoint. I personally think that even they had free choice, but if someone wants to say, well, God sovereignly has decided to save a certain individual because He wanted him for a certain purpose that was very unusual, and therefore God kind of suspended the normal process of free will and chose the man He wanted for His work, I could see that as not necessarily violating the general principles of free will in the human being. And certainly God in that case didn't consign anyone to hell by His unilateral choice, but rather the choice was simply to call somebody to certainly be saved, whereas everyone else kind of has to take the chances and be saved or not as they choose. That's not my view, but I've heard other people say something like that. And I don't think it's heretical. It may be different than what I think is true, but there's certainly no reason anyone should be alarmed by that suggestion. Anyway, I'm out of time, Matt. I appreciate your call.
All right. Well, God bless you, Steve. And,
thank you.
Have a good day.
Thanks for sharing with us. God bless you.
All right, bye.
Bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do this live Monday through Friday for an hour each afternoon. And if you'd like to listen in daily and call in when you have questions, that's what we'd like for you to do. That's why we're here. It's a caller-driven show. There's also a morning version of The Narrow Path each weekday morning from 9:30 to 10 Pacific Time. That's not on these same stations, on different stations, but you can't get them where you're sitting because the stations cover different areas. But you can hear them on the website if you'd like to. The Narrow Path is listener supported. You can write to us at or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, for information. Thanks for joining us.